Hey now, welcome back to the Deadology Podcast from Pencil Hill Studio, New Paltz, New York. I'm your host, Howard Weiner. This is Season 4, Episode 4 of the podcast. Today, March 11th, 2026, we're going to go back 45 years and to a show from the Uptown Theater in Chicago from February 26th, 1981. It was the first show of the year, an unreal opening for the Grateful Dead that year. Most years, first show of a tour, mediocre. They're just kind of laying the groundwork for what's going to be later in the tour. But this is a tremendous opener, like really one of the better shows of the tour. So I'm going to be all over this show today, and it's a special period for me in Grateful Dead history, because this is where I kind of got on the bus during 1981. I've probably mentioned this story here before. I've written about it in my book, so I'll kind of make it brief. But I remember the date. I don't remember the date. I found the date later on. January 24th, 1981, I was at a hockey game in the Nassau Coliseum. The Islanders were playing the Quebec Nordiques. Mike Bossy, my favorite player, made hockey history that night, becoming the second player in NHL history to score 50 goals in his first 50 games of the season. And he scored two goals like in the last 5 minutes of the game, so it was pretty incredible. We were freaking going nuts, man. We went out to the parking lot, people were beeping and cheering. It was the coolest live event I'd ever been to. And then my friend Seymour lights up a joint and puts Europe 72 into the tape deck. And I knew a few Grateful Dead songs, but I really didn't understand what the big fuss was about the band. And man, Europe 72 just did it, man. I was like, my God, what is this? It's the thing with the Grateful Dead, it's a complete different genre of music. If you're listening to FM and AM radio all your life, you start off with Cumberland Blues, electrified bluegrass. Then you're getting It Hurts Me Too, Pigpen belting out the blues, just stuff you didn't hear, I had never heard on the radio before. And then you go country, Jerry doing a beautiful version of Hank Williams' You Win Again. It was just so mesmerizing. It was unbelievable. It's like it just all clicked that night for me. I'm like, wow, what a band this is. So diverse, a different universe than any other band. Even to this day, no one's ever kind of gotten into all these different amalgamation of genres, man. And then the Grateful Dead just throwing their secret sauce on it, man. And they had it going in Europe 72 for sure. So I went out, bought a bunch of Grateful Dead albums. My first show, March 9th, 81. Unbelievable show, Madison Square Garden. But yet I didn't have any bootleg tapes, so it was almost like a little too advanced for me. Even though they played Ramble on Rose, which was my favorite song at the time, I didn't even realize how great of a show it was, until I heard the tapes later on. I finally started getting some bootleg tapes, and by May of that year, I was 1,000% in. And here I am 45 years later, no let up, Grateful Dead all the way. So let's go back to February 26, 1981. Throughout the 80s, when they would start a tour, it would be first couple of shows would be a little rough. You were very happy if you caught an awesome show in your first one or two. It usually would be that third, fourth, fifth where they really start picking up the pace and playing great music and really doing something special. But on this tour, man, they just hit it right off from the beginning. And a lot of ways, this show reminds me, different songs, different style, but it reminds me of the February 26, 77 show from Swing Auditorium in San Bernardino. I did a podcast with Doug Schmell on that about a year ago on 2/26/77. Just an unbelievable show to start the year, and that's what we get here in Chicago. So they open up, right away they go straight to heaven. Feel Like a Stranger, Althea, from their most recent album, Go to Heaven. And these are the same two songs they opened up with on at my first show, Madison Square Garden, March 9th, 81. Those versions from 3/9/81 are two of the best versions ever. So as the tour progressed, they kept getting hotter with the playing on those songs. But pretty awesome stuff here to open up the show. Feel Like a Stranger, it's the first show of the tour. And when they go to the big instrumental portion, you could tell they're just trying to get the sound down. Like they left enough room to jam, but it was more like they're playing around just with levels, trying to get everything to sound just exactly right, because it was a little off as they were going through the jam, and they realized that, so they're kind of trading licks. I mean, it sounds pretty cool, but they really couldn't catch fire because they were just trying to get the sound down. So they open up That Stranger, and then everything changes with the second song, Althea. This is a smoking Althea, but just, you know, I really got to the to understand it and like get into it when I listened to it for this podcast. I knew it was good, but it was much better than I thought. This is one of the best Altheas ever, just all the way through. Jerry singing, the playing, and we're going to get the first audio highlight of this, the final jam of the Althea. But for this song and Feel Like a Stranger, 1980 and 81 were the years. They were just all over this. They really took off on both of these. You get most of the best versions ever from these 2 years. And this one from the Uptown Theater is up there, man. It's at least top seven, maybe even top five. It's that good. So check out the magic from Jerry at the end of this Althea. Man, they were loving it in Chicago that night. The Grateful Dead in peak form, mid-tour form, with only the second song of the night. Amazing version of Althea there. And just listening to it again, obviously Jerry goes off that you know, that's obvious. You don't even need to discuss anything there. Just the great guitar work. But listening to it again this time, I'm just kind of amazed at how tight the band was and what everybody was doing individually on that fill. Bobby had some really tasty slide fills in there, and Brent coming in with the right fills in between Garcia's licks. It was just a beautiful group effort there, besides the obvious Mr. Garcia on fire. Another thing about this show, if, let's say, the Grateful Dead approached me in 1981, they said, "Son, this is your lucky day. You get to pick our set list. And here's the only rule. You got to stick with songs in the slots you'd expect to hear them. Like, you can't tell us to play Saint Stephen to open the show or Dark Star or something like that. You got to go basically with our repertoire and put the songs in the slots where we usually put them. I would have came, this first set would have been something I would have said, here you go, here, play these songs. So basically they played all these desirable songs, which is also very unusual for a first show of a tour to get like all these great tunes, which they're going to do on this night. But yeah, my stamp of approval on everything and every selection in the spot they were put in. Third song. Oh, by the way, after I finish doing the going through the Chicago show, there's going to be a return of Album of the Week by popular demand. So we're going to get in Album of the Week after I go through the Chicago show with you. Song three, Little Red Rooster. In 1981 would be a year of alternating. You either got Rooster one night or CeCe Ryder the other night. There may have been one or two nights where it didn't happen, but I think almost every after, yeah. Well, I'll double check that one day, but at least 95% of the shows have either Rooster or CeCe Ryder that play one night, one the other night. And man, back in the day, there was no doubt about it. Our favorite was Little Red Rooster, which Chicago gets in the third spot here. Just Garcia's solo never failed to disappoint. And back in 1981, they really hit it off. 82 was also a good year for Rooster. In 1980, I think that was the first year they broke out the tune. It wasn't exactly, just something about the way 81, they finally got it down. Brent's keyboard, Bobby's slide, and then Jerry just shreds. So they finally got it down exactly right. And over the years, they just lost, or at least maybe Jerry did, and some of the band lost the love of Rooster. It was never as hot as it was back in these 81, 82 years. And this one is no exception, man. Garcia rips a great lead. Brent's keyboards are awesome on this during his turn. So, yeah, very good Rooster in the third spot. You know, so the show's got a lot of energy going, and then they deliver the Bird Song. yeah, man, a huge major song, and number four, getting Bird Song early in a show was always such a great credit to that set list. It always gets you psyched up. So Bird Song 4 is an awesome choice, and they'd only had been doing Electric Bird Songs a couple times at the end of 80. At the end of 1973, they stopped doing Birdsong, and then they brought it back for the acoustic shows in 1980. And when they returned it to the electric lineup, I think this might be the fifth electric version after the acoustic shows. Just Jerry was psyched to be playing Birdsong again. Kind of unusual that they went that long without playing it. But once they got it back in the lineup, it would be there for 15 years straight, man. Jerry loved the Birdsong. And this version, Jerry's engaged all the way through. Beautiful singing. It's intense playing right away. Now, when we're talking about Birdsong, the Cole Fieldhouse on March 7th, later in this tour, is the longest version ever. Arguably the best version. I mean, there's some great ones from that 72-73 period, but if I had to go with what I thought the best Bird Song, that Cole Fieldhouse is unreal. 17 minutes of Bird Song. The next show, Jerry would play it again. So Garcia was really into the Bird Song, and just a beautiful version here. Number fifth song of the first set, it's Cowboy Time, a little double shot from Bobby Weir, Me and My Uncle. And then, once again, since this is a desirable set list, we get Big River on the heels of Uncle. And whenever I was at a show, I would hear Uncle or Mama Try, and I would be praying for Big River. And there was always like a tinge of disappointment if they went into Mexicali. Now, that's nothing against Mexicali. It's just Big River is the song. One of Johnny Cash's greatest tunes ever. And just, you're going to get a better jam in Big River than you are in Mexicali, so you'd always be sitting there rooting for the Big River. And on this night, they delivered it in Chicago. And this is a top-notch version. I'm sorry I didn't cut a little audio highlight of it. But Jerry takes it beyond the normal length, does a couple more rounds. It's smoking hot. This first set is definitely a first set you're going to want to check out the whole thing. Great Big River. So we're about hitting up to song number 7, and being that it's one of those desirable nights where you're getting every song you want to hear, Peggy O in the 7th spot, Pretty Peggy O. And the playing here is, Jerry's like right on the money. This one isn't an extended, you know, more so than another version, but just the playing is so beautiful. Yeah, 1981, man, the Grateful Dead were locked in. I think, you know, people love the year, but I think it's even underrated. Just, you know, there's so much amazing playing, you know, and all these songs were still in the rotation, The Passenger, and, you know, songs that would get weeded out for In the Dark songs, you know, Lazy Lightning, Supplication. They really had a great repertoire going, and on most nights they were dead on, and the band was, you know, they were really communicating. Whereas as time went on, when you hit 83, 84, you get some of Garcia's best playing, but the band's not really communicating as well as he did back in this year. So this is just a beautiful version of Peggy O. You know, when I heard Garcia's jam, it was just awesome. But not as long as some other ones, but it was pretty awesome. And did all those comments for the next two songs, Passenger and Tennessee Jed. I love Passenger. It's a shame they stopped playing that song. Such a great little powder keg of a song. You know, definitely would beats Brother Esau and stuff like that. Wonder why they stopped playing Passenger. You know, Brent was hot on Passenger. His playing's great on that. It really put a charge into it, and Tenny said it was involved in. So yeah, this is a good version, like the Peggy O, not extra long or anything, but just intense playing, and the band's all over it. Good Tennessee Jed, the song before the set ender. Once again, along those lines, just, you know, really, really good, nothing extraordinary. But the beauty of this show is the consistency all the way through, with the exception of Stranger, because they were trying to dial in the equipment. Every version here is on the money. There's not a misstep. And there's a lot of songs that kind of stand out. And the one that ends the set definitely is a standout. Music never stopped. As you guys probably know, it's one of my all-time favorites. And for them to, for the first night of the tour, to break out and Music Never Stopped, and to just really, really nail it, an all-time great version, it's incredible. So a few years back, maybe seven years ago, I came out with a book, Deadology Volume 2, where I looked at the 33 Grateful Dead jam anthems and kind of talked about their evolution. And I didn't want to do a 1-2-3 rating kind of thing on the best versions, but I would pick out about 10 of the best versions of the song and discuss them a little bit. This wasn't in my Music Never Stops section. It should be, because I think when I wrote the book, I didn't even realize how good this version was. So this is like a real sneaky show. I don't think it's considered one of the best or anything, but it really, for 1981, definitely one of the best of that year. Just, you know, maybe because it's the first show of the year, it's in the middle of a pretty good, it's, you know, it's part of a good tour that had the Big Garden shows. For whatever reason, I think this show gets overlooked a lot, but it's a powerhouse, man. And this Music Never Stopped, I think I should have put it in that Deadology book. It's so good. And what sets this one apart, we're going to hear a nice audio highlight from this Music Never Stopped. Jerry just, they do everything you want to hear, A to Z, and it's really intense. I mean, they come out of that Music Never Stopped when they do the turnover jam, and then they march ahead with the basic melody line, you know, the big punch going home. Just incredible, man. Garcia's ripping at an amazing pace, and the band's right there with him, and they play it. You listen to it, you're like, this is one of the best. You had to be in the audience. You had to be floored by how good it was. And then it reaches what is the logical end. They went A to Z. And then Garcia does the one thing that really separates him from other guitarists. He finds those impossible notes. The exclamation point to when a song is logically over and it can't possibly go anymore. Somehow Garcia finds these 30 extra seconds to bring one more exclamation point when I don't even know how another guitarist could think of doing it. Like, Garcia really had this knack of just, let me just push it beyond the barrier. Whenever he did that, he was in the mood, he was on fire. So he picked the right times to do it. the band kind of heard that, like, you know, they were kind of finished, but they heard that Garcia wasn't finished, so they managed to keep it going. And it just turns out to be just it's a freaking riot. This music never stops. So I'm going to play it for you right now. And just a little advice before I hit the play button on this. Everybody should stay safe and shelter in place for this jam. Enjoy. There you go. Jerry was in the mood. You could even hear him hitting these notes as they're closing it out with the final chord. He didn't want to stop, man. And the band was so on. When you listen to that, Bobby was doing some amazing quick strumming on that. And that was the point where it just seemed like it had reached this logical end. And Garcia just found these notes, which he never found. The music never stopped before, and did like a three-tiered, beautiful lead there, man. Just very unique to the Uptown Theater show here. So just that's what we love about Garcia. Just he finds these unbelievable leads, and when it doesn't seem possible, you know, just that's what makes him, in our estimation, the greatest guitarist, musician ever. And we get that music never stopped at all. Scrubbing, fanning, change of direction. But it was it never slowed up. It was just full speed ahead, step on the gas. And set two in Chicago, the Grateful Dead, Keep the Mojo Rolling, open up with China Cat Rider. And at this point, China Cat had really returned to the rotation. They brought it back in 79, 80, but it kind of, it was weird. It wasn't as good as it had been in 73 and 74. And sometimes they would tuck it into the first set. But 1981, I think it really came of age. They had a great year with China Cat, and it really settled into the second set opener role, as it did here in the Uptown Theater. China Cat's the type of song that builds its own momentum. It doesn't need to be in the middle of a set or at the end of a set. It's great to start a set because China Cat can set the pace for the entire second set. So it's a perfect second set opener, really hot version here. If you want to hear the best China Cat from 1981, my first show, Madison Square, even though I didn't realize it that night, 3981, that China Cat rider is ridiculous, but especially the cat, and the rider is one of the best too. But the cool thing about this Uptown Theater show is the rider is just an absolute sizzling smoker. And one of the best you'll ever hear. So I'm going to have to stop talking and get back to Jerry. Here we go. This is the second solo of the Amazing Rider from 22681. There you go, the great Chicago Rider of 1981. And I'm thinking back to when I first acquired this show and first heard it. It was probably back in 2002, something like that. I was going, finding all these Rogues Grateful Dead sites where you could download shows, and they would take hours and hours to download one show. And I was just so excited. I bought a computer just to download Grateful Dead shows. I didn't care about the other things computers could do. My friend Jim Kerr Jr., We lived in the Upper East Side of New York City. I met this guy, and he was telling me about computers and how you could download dead shows. I was like, I got to get a computer. Then for the next few years, I spent so much time just downloading Grateful Dead as long as it took. I would wake my, I would set my computer, download a show, and if you went 15 minutes without keeping the downloads going, they would log you out and you would have to fight to get back in. And I mean, I would wake myself up in the middle of the night just to keep the downloads rolling in. And I remember getting this show and just looking at it, I was like, what a great set list. If this show is any good, it's the first show of the tour. If they're playing hot, it's going to be an amazing show. And I was impressed with it right away. They played the 27th and 28th. Both those are really good set lists. And, you know, everything was well thought out at these first three shows and brilliantly played. So moving on after the Rider, they actually come to a stop after Rider, and then they play Samson. Usually they'll slam right into Samson out of the Rider, but I think they kicked it around for a second and then said, hey, let's do Samson. And, you know, just as you would expect from what you've heard so far with this show, awesome Samson. And the one thing that continues to stick out as I listen, you know, I've had a number of listens to this show, maybe six or seven prior to doing the podcast. You know, I was going to do the podcast a week or two ago. A couple of things popped up and I couldn't get to it. So I had to keep listening to it, which it was a joy to listen to this Brent Midland's playing. By this time, he's at the start of his third year. He is so comfortable. You listen to what he's doing on all these tunes. His playing is just incredible. You hear about people who don't like Brent Midland's playing. I mean, sure, it's obviously different than Keith's playing, but I don't get it. The guy was just fantastic, especially by this time in '81. You just hear what he's doing, complimenting the songs here. And when it's time for him to step up and play, man, what does he play? So we get a hot Samson. Unusual that it starts off by itself without coming out of the Rider. And then the first slow tune of the night, for the first ballad where things actually calm down for a second or two, He's Gone, in the fourth spot here. And Jerry has one vocal flub. He's like, steal your head, face off, right off your head, like that. But besides that, there weren't many, many miscues on this night at all, man. Just the singing, the playing, perfect. Now, if you look at Dead Bass, or, you know, re-listen or wherever you get your music from, I don't see that anyone anywhere mentions that there's a jam here. Because He's Gone, if you don't call it a jam, is 23 minutes here. There is a huge improvisational jam after the He's Gone. Well, obviously a very well-played He's Gone, keeping up the continuity of the show. And then they just go into this jam, which occasionally they would do after He's Gone. An even more impressive version of a jam after He's Gone from this year, Nassau Coliseum, May 6th, 81, where they go into a 15-minute improvisation, which has a caution jam in it, a Spanish jam in it. That's legendary. That's on Dick's Picks. I believe it's either 13 or 15. Great jam there. But this one is not too far off, man. They go off for like 11 minutes. I was really surprised to see that where I looked, they hadn't marked this as a separate jam. It's a jam unto itself, man. It's incredible. So we're gonna hear a bit of it. So they just start jamming. They know they're going off on a little thing here. And they also did this kind of thing in 1979. It was pretty common before the drums to do some improvisational jams. And this one's a beaut, man. It's just like, first it sounds like they're doing another one. Bass thing. It doesn't sound like they're going to go into it, but they're noodling kind of like in another one fashion, maybe giving you a preview of what's to come after drums. And then the jam just takes on a mind of its own and some incredible playing, and everybody's involved. It's not like someone went off stage and Phil said, hey, let me put my bass down. The whole band is involved, and it's a beautiful jam. It deserves its own name. Windy City, whatever, whatever name you want to give it. It morphs into its own little jam. And then they start doing something which is a little Not Fade Away based. So listening to this, you think you might get another one or not fade away after drums, but you get neither. But just a tremendous, nice improvisational jam here. And we definitely got to take a listen to that. So here you go. This is several minutes of that jam after he's gone.
Thank you.
I mean, how could you not love this show, man? That improvisation goes on for another 5 minutes or so. Incredible to hear this kind of thing. First show of the year, 1981. Huge year for the Grateful Dead and the Jerry Garcia Band as well. February 81, some of the best Garcia Band shows you'll ever hear. So it kind of makes, from that viewpoint, it makes sense of how hot they came into this Chicago show here. So the ending of the show is pretty typical. Nothing extraordinary, but very consistent. You know, the one thing this show has, there's no throwaway or off versions on this night. They really kind of, everything's good to great, you know, in that, if you're rating it, 8 to 10 in that range, everything was, just so well played. So even if they did something pretty typical at the end here, still the way they played it was pretty extraordinary on this night. After drums, we get a Truckin'. And it's a very cool kind of weird opening to the Truckin'. Everything was, it was a little bit unusual, a little bit of something to every song this night. Truckin', good jam, goes into Black Peter. Once again, Jerry's voice is on this night. And just Black Peter is one of these songs which I really appreciated more after I had seen, after my years touring, I really took a loving to Black Peter. Maybe after Jerry's coma, I think that's really where I really said, damn, I freaking love this song, you know, more than I had previously. So you get a Black Peter into Going Down the Road Feeling Bad. And a very cool transition, the opening of Going Down the Road Feeling Bad, I love here. 81's an excellent year for a lot of good versions of Going Down the Road. The, you know, as the, once again, as the years went on here, as we go into the mid-80s, later 80s, they went through, they kind of ran through Going Down the Road a little too quickly. But this version is really nice. The opening, the first jam is hot. I mean, there are some better versions, but I like this one a lot. So I'm going to play this as the outro tonight. The Going Down the Road Feeling Bad will be the last song. And then Going Down the Road Feeling Bad into Johnny Be Good. I kind of liked it because it catches you off guard. You get the great rock and roll Chuck Berry, Johnny Be Good. And the most impressive thing for me listening to this was Brent's solo on the organ, man, on the Hammond. He just killed this Johnny Be Good. And just a real nice upbeat way to finish the show and U.S. Blues to close it out. So the after drums, not as exciting as the first part of the show, obviously, but still, when everything's played well, I mean, every time I listened to this, I totally enjoyed that Truckin' Peter, Going Down the Road Feeling Bad, Johnny Be Good, U.S. Blues Encore. So it's all so well played, just a dynamite show and one of the best openers of any year. You know, maybe the Swing Auditorium has it beat. Tough for me to think of a better year opener than this one right here. Incredible stuff from the Grateful Dead. And Chicago had two more awesome performances to go on the 27th and 28th. And you really caught everything you'd ever want to catch in those three shows. So now we're going to move on to the album of the week. It's back. I was planning on recording this episode about a week ago, March 2nd. I was in Lake Placid. I had everything. I had packed everything for my trip, and I overpacked. The one thing I forgot was to bring my microphone, so I had to put off recording the episode till I returned to New Paltz. But March 2nd was Karen Carpenter's birthday. She would have been 76. And I said, hey, for my album of the week, A Song for You by the Carpenters. Definitely their greatest album. If you have not gotten into the Carpenters, I can't blame you. I've only had this revelation about 2 years ago. But A Song for You. Check this album out. I promise you'll be like, holy shit. I never knew that, you know, they were this good. A Song for You, tremendous album. But before I get into that album and why it's different from the rest of the stuff the Carpenters did, I just had a few words, want to say a few things about Karen Carpenter, who's like one of my musical heroes now, which is unbelievable. I would have laughed at that thought like three years ago. But just the ultimate story of complete triumph and unexpected rise to fame and just a generational music talent. you know, that's, I love how they use generational talent, like on sports now, everybody's a generational talent, but she really was one of the all-time greats and had one of the great, just unbelievable, impossible early rises to fame. And then obviously the horrible tragedy of, you know, the last number of years of her life. But check this out. So Karen Carpenter is 15 years old. She hasn't played drums yet, and she hasn't sang in a band. She's a 15-year-old kid. There's a lot of music in the house. Her Richard, her brother, is a piano prodigy. She decides to play the drums. And, you know, she's, you know, playing with Richard. They form a little band, this and that. And then they realize that she's a great singer. So she starts to sing. And at this point, she's going to take it seriously. You know, it's she's into it. She's good at it. Within 4 years, she's the best singer in the world and a world-class drummer. Now, that's one of the most incredible things. It's like when you think of Dylan, say, how did Dylan write all these songs? You know, how did Garcia become this? You know, how did Robert Hunter write those great songs? And you're blown away by what a person could do in a short period of time and just achieve that kind of greatness. She was singing number one hits and playing drums, which no woman did. In 1969, 1970, and just it came out of nowhere, man. Obviously, she put a lot of work into it, but like, how does that happen? How does someone who has really no life experience, lives in Downey, California, just develop like this wisdom and this power in her singing? To me, she's the greatest female greatest vocalist ever, man. I put her number one. Just perfect pitch and incredible emotion. Just unfortunately, her best work was in a short period of time. She wasn't able to sustain it, but that's a whole nother story of why that happened. But what she did in those up and through this Song for You album, 1972, just unbelievable. One of the most incredible. You know, nobody could explain it. It was almost too much for even everybody to grasp. Like A&M obviously signed the Carpenters because of her, and even though Richard was a genius piano prodigy, he was part of the package. You know, they were interested in Karen because they heard that voice and they're like, my God, you know, you have gold when you hear that voice. And I think the key turning point in her career was like, the people would go see the Carpenters and they would just be like people on stage just playing instruments. So there was no stage show, no excitement, nowhere to look. There was this great voice and like, where is it coming from? There's this chick behind the drums. You couldn't, so it wasn't, their music wasn't made for a live rock show. In a lot of ways, they were like the Grateful Dead like that. They were just into playing their instruments. They didn't put much time into a musical show. But eventually her brother, A&M Records, they said, Karen, man, you got to get out from behind the drums and you got to sing. And she was very uncomfortable doing it. She eventually got decent at it, but she was always uncomfortable doing it. She had, I thought she was pretty beautiful. She had self-image issues and stuff like that. So she was forced from doing what she loved, and she was kind of neutered. It's like, hey, this woman became such a great drummer in 4 years. You should be encouraging her. You should be saying, hey, pick up another instrument. What songs can you write a song? You know, that they should have like, they should have realized that they had a genius, a musical, not just the lead singer, but a musical genius. But yeah, that's 1970. The world was definitely a little more sexist back then. And so from the point where they took her away from her drums, I think that deeply affected her. And she was battling anorexia, in my opinion, for the last 10 years of her career, from about 72, 73 on, except it became much more obvious by 74, 75. And this woman who sings like this, such deep, you know, emotional, she lived no life. She never broke away from home. You know, she never had a chance to go to a Grateful Dead show. You know, she was just trapped in this Carpenter's womb. And she died in her mother's house at the age 32 in 1983. It's insane. It's one of the saddest things ever. So, you know, she had the fame and she was like, hey, I just got to go along with this. I got to sing. And, you know, it's hard to grow creatively when you're trapped and you're smothered like that. It ended up being a terrible tragedy. But the first, man, those first four albums, there's some great songs in there. And let's jump right into A Song for You, which is an unbelievable album. I can't imagine anybody who likes the Grateful Dead or likes music listening to this and not kind of enjoying it. It's that good. So the first song is one of the big keys here, A Song for You, written by Leon Russell. I had never heard this song before. You know, you think of the Carpenters, you think of all their hit songs. I got this album, I was like, whoa, what is this? It's incredible. It's one of Leon Russell's best lyrics he ever written. I love you in a place where there's no space and time. The lyrics aren't coming to me right now exactly, but just a brilliant song, but something that was never put on radio as a single. They never put it out as a single. It would have been great on FM radio. Right now, if you played this on FM radio, it would fit right in with whatever's going on. Just an incredible song, and it set the tempo of like a themed album, which is the only one where they really had the whole thing going with a themed album. They had these great stacked vocals, and on this album, you do get a couple of good guitar licks later on, but even the instrumentals here, this is stuff I wouldn't listen for in the Carpenters' music when I was younger. Everything is just immaculate, great arrangements, but a song for you, just a killer opener on the album. I can't imagine somebody listening to this and saying, I don't like this. You know, it's an incredible tune. And then this album just has it going on, man. It's the theme based. So, you know, A Song for You, Leon Russell's writing about being out on the road and, you know, and finding love, you know, and stuff. Once again, all the lyrics get me, because I don't know this like Dylan or the Dead, but just an intense song. Second song, Top of the World. They had so many singles on this album, they didn't even realize that was going to be their biggest hit. I think it went to number one, but that was only after they came out with their singles album a year later. Great tune. This on this album is the better version, the one they actually released. Even though it's subtle, there's something about this version. Pretty cool lyrics. John Bettis and Richard Carpenter wrote this, so Bettis was the lyric guy. He did like Touch of the Breeze with the leaves and the trees, almost like a Dylan line from Mississippi. So there's actually really great lyric writing on this, kind of surprising when you really break it down and listen to it. And the irony of it, it really was a metaphor of the Carpenter situation at that time. They were on top of the world, and wouldn't never get better than that. It was mostly downhill after this, so it's kind of like a sad being on top of the world. But that's the other thing that makes this album work, is just that there's a positivity to it. It's like a lot of Karen's songs from the last album, Superstar, For All We Know, Rainy Days and Mondays, some of their best work ever. I freaking love those songs. But they overpowered the rest of the album. The rest of the album was like inferior to those songs. This has like that, the balance that an album needs, that, no song is bigger than the album. So that's one of the reasons this Song for You album works. Third spot, Hurting Each Other. This is a song I don't love. I like it. I like it just because of Karen's voice. But I think this went to number three. So they were just, man, people were just eating up the Carpenters at this time. And they had that squeaky clean image. And, you know, so there was a kind of like a love-hate thing going on with the Carpenters. But, you know, they were what they were. You know, they weren't, you know, pushing philosophy or anything. They had no life experience outside of being in a family in Downey. But the music is insane. It's so good. Hurting Each Other, I could take it or leave it. But the key song of this whole album, where you're like, hey, this is a freaking great album. It's Gonna Take Some Time, written by Carole King. Obviously, she's a great songwriter. And just the arrangement, Karen's voice, perfect. Unbelievable. This might be my favorite song on the album. It's Gonna Take Some Time. It's just something about it. I listened to Aretha, Billie Holiday, Carly Simon, Natalie Merchant, some other great singers that I've always loved, female singers. Just when I started getting into Karen Carpenter, I'm like, this is it, man. There's something about her voice that just, you know, hits some kind of emotion. And I think it does for anybody who really likes the Carpenters. And then there's that tough thing to battle with, because as their career went on, they had a less interesting, you know, really pop song, sing a song and stuff like that. So, you know, that didn't help out their reputation as far as being cool or anything. But this album has everything. It's flat out cool. And the fifth song, Goodbye to Love, a song I like. Once again, here we got a hit song again. This is considered to be the first power ballad. Tony Peluso plays a couple leads on this, which are really cool. Good tune, and you know, they probably did start the trend of the power ballad here, you know. So Richard Carpenter likes to take credit for that, but it's probably really is the beginning of power ballads. Good tune, not as much as I love some of the other ones, but definitely a great classic Carpenter's tune. So right there, five songs. You have an incredible side of music, definitely the best side of music the Carpenters ever did. And then the next thing, they do an intermission, like a little vocal thing. Richard and Karen about having to take a bathroom break. Once their vocals are perfect, but once again, it proves how dorky they are, and what kind of killed their reputation, hurt them as far as being loved by you know, regular fans who would listen to FM radio, that kind of thing. Second side of this album, I'm going to kind of go through this a little quicker. Bless the Beasts and Children. It was written for a movie soundtrack. Incredible. Just once again, Karen Carpenter, I could listen to that voice all day. Just insane. Such great singing. And, you know, a good arrangement, movie soundtrack, but just there's something about her. It just sucks me right in when I hear that. Flat Baroque, next song, a little piano thing from Richard Carpenter, which is pretty cool. And then he does a song, Piano Picker, and this song needed to be cut from the album. It's the one blemish, just a horrible little song. Poor guy he was a piano genius, but he was looking to get more fame, more recognition. And he did have to, unfortunately he had to eat it. Yeah, that Karen was the everything in this band. As much as he tried, he deserves all the credit for what he did. Richard Carpenter would be writing movie soundtracks or composing somewhere if it weren't, and nobody would know who he was if it wasn't for Karen. We got to be honest about that. Then a couple more songs here. Won't Last a Day Without You. Just another brilliant vocal performance, and the choral vocals. Just the Carpenter's music, like when they're at the best, like on this album, is just so rich and such a joy to listen to. That was written by Roger Nichols, Paul Williams. Paul Williams wrote some great songs, and he wrote Rainy Days and Mondays. He's a pretty damn good songwriter, and the Carpenters definitely benefited from a few of his tunes. Then Crystal Lullaby, a song which really hasn't, it's probably a good song. It hasn't really hit me yet as far as being great. The last song, and then there's a reprise, Road Ode. This kind of finishes the whole concept feel. Thematic albums were the big deal back then, and the Carpenters really put one together here that was beautiful, man. It totally worked. And just, man, once again, Karen singing on this Road Ode is just incredible. And then they do the little reprise back into a song for you from the beginning. Kind of like if you think of Band on the Run, Paul McCartney, and Wings, where they open with Band on the Run, they finish with a little Band on the Run reprise. That's what's like this here. But this was before Band on the Run. I bet Paul McCartney listened to this and came up with the idea from this album. Paul McCartney gives all the credit in the world to Karen Carpenter as being a great singer, man. And just, for a couple of years now, been about 2 years, I've been like totally hooked on listening to these great performances from Karen Carpenter. Yeah, more than I'd say I'm into the Carpenters, I'm into Karen Carpenter, man. She was brilliant. It's just so sad that she never got to really enjoy life, experience life, and become what she could have been, because as great as this is, she had so much more to give the world artistically. It's a damn shame. But the stuff that she did, never be forgotten, man. Love Karen Carpenter. And hey, guys, listen, if you're laughing right now and saying I've gone mad, just listen to A Song for You, that album. And I think you'll be surprised, because if you love Grateful Dead music, you have taste. One other comparison, like, on the stage, they were both the same, just, you know, musicians playing, no show. But the Carpenters were the complete opposite of the Grateful Dead, obviously, in a lot of ways. But they tried to play everything exactly as the record, you know, which is, it's kind of crazy. And they admit to it, and they tried, and, you know, and they were pretty damn good at doing that. Maybe that's why they were never, people came to see them because they were the Carpenters, but they never... You don't need to get live Carpenter albums. You know, the only reason to listen or watch a live Carpenter album is just to watch Karen Carpenter. Otherwise, you could just live off the albums here. But guaranteed, give it a shot. A Song for You, great Carpenter's album. I think next week I'm going to go for a Jerry Garcia Band show. Haven't done a Jerry show in a while. We're going to get Doug Schmell back the following week. And yeah, things are rolling here on the Deadology Podcast. It's a pleasure to be doing this for you. My website, tangleupintunes.com. Email, catfishgarcia82@yahoo.com. Speak to you all next week. Peace out. We'll be right back.
Thank you.